on top of the tongue, can six, chapter number four, and of course this is the beginning of unit 21. So,
can I do the old exam?
You can. You want to do that now? You can if you like.
I can do it in maybe about 5 minutes.
Okay.
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 Yeah. You just tell me when.
Yeah.
So for others who want to catch up on that exam,
later,
another time, yeah, another week, yeah, a little bit more study. Michelle, anyone else? What's that? All done. Okay, chapter 21, this is about the Radha Daksha. I'll give you some. You've got it on the soft copy, but I'll give you the third copy next week as well. So, chapters 4 to 6, so another 3-chapter unit. First of all, we'll read the summary, and I might just read the summary of the whole 3 chapters just to get an overview of the whole unit. So this is first of all chapter 4. Maharaj Parikshit asked Sukadeva Goswami to talk more about the creation of the various living entities during the period of Svayambhuva Manu and of the potency of the Lord by which he brought about the secondary creation. Sukadeva Goswami informed him that when the Pachakas, the 10 sons of Prachinabhari, entered the sea to execute austerities, the planet Earth was neglected because of the absence of a king. Naturally, many weeds and unnecessary trees grew and no food grains were produced. Indeed, all the land became like a forest. When the 10 Pachakas came out of the sea and saw the entire world full of trees, they were very angry with the trees and decided to destroy them all to rectify the situation. Thus, the Pachakas created wind and fire to burn the trees to ashes. Soma, however, the king of the moon and the king of all vegetation, forbade the Pachakas to destroy the trees, since the trees are the source of fruit and flowers for all living beings. Just to satisfy the Pachakas, Soma gave them a beautiful girl born of Vamlocha Apsara. By the semen of all the Pachakas, Daksha was born of that girl. With his mind, Daksha created all kinds of various living entities. But feeling unsatisfied, he decided to perform austerities so that he could finish his task properly. He chanted the Hamsaguhi prayers, which pleased the Lord greatly. Being thus pleased by Daksha's prayers, the Lord appeared before him in his beautifully dressed and decorated 8-armed form. Daksha assumed the position of Dandavat, but he could not speak due to the overwhelming happiness he was feeling. Understanding the heart of Daksha, the Lord congratulated him for his austerities and aimed at better serving the Supreme Lord by, and aims at better serving the Supreme Lord by creating various progeny. The beautiful Astabhuja form then told about how Lord Brahma similarly underwent austerities by the Lord's inspiration. Brahma was able to perform his duty. The Lord then offered Daksha a suitable wife named Asithi, who would beget hundreds of children and immediately vanished. Summary of chapters 5 and 6. Chapter 5. Influenced by the external energy of Lord Vishnu, Prajapati Daksha begot 10,000 sons, the Haryaspas, in the womb of his wife, Panchajani. Ordered by their father to create more and more population, the Haryaspas went west to the place where the river Sindhu, now the Indus, meets the Arabian Sea. When Śrīla Narada Muni saw these boys engaged in such commendable austerities, simply for material creation, he thought it better to release them from this tendency. Narada Muni described to the boys the ultimate goal of life and advised them not to become ordinary karmis, to beget children. Thus all the sons of Daksha became enlightened and left and never to return. Prajapati Daksha, who was very sad at the loss of his sons, begot 1,000 more sons in the womb of his wife, Panchajani, and ordered them to increase progeny. These sons, who were named the Savalasas, also engaged in worshipping Lord Vishnu to beget children, but Narada Muni convinced them to become mendicants and not to beget children. Foiled twice in his attempts to increase population, Japati Daksha became most angry at Narada Muni and cursed him, saying that in the future he would not be able to stay anywhere. Since Narada Muni, being fully qualified, was fixed in tolerance, he accepted Daksha's curse. As described in this chapter, chapter 6, Prajapati Daksha begot 60 daughters in the womb of his wife, Asithi. These daughters were given in charity to various persons to increase the population. Since these offspring of Daksha were women, Narada Muni did not try to lead them toward the renounced Lord of Life. Thus, the daughters were saved from Narada Muni. 10 of the daughters were given in marriage to Dharmaraj, 13 to Kashyapa Muni, and 27 to the moon god, Chandra. In this way, 50 daughters were distributed, and of the other 10 daughters, 4 were given to Kashyapa, and two each to Bhuta, Angira, and Krashva. One should know that it is because of the union of these 60 daughters with various exalted personalities that the entire universe was filled with various kinds of living entities, such as human beings, demigods, demons, beasts, birds, and serpents. So, you'll see that this unit has one essay question, a deluded mission. The next statements from Canto 6, Chapters 4 and 5, which reflect Prabhupada's mood and mission and discuss their significance. How important are these aspects of Prabhupada's mood and mission for ISKCON in general? So, just bear that in mind as we go through. Alright, so there's... Let's have a look at this chapter, chapter 4. Blessed King said to Sukadeva Goswami, "My dear Lord, the demigods, demons, human beings, nagas, beasts, and birds were created during the reign of Swayambhuva Manu. You have spoken about this creation briefly in the third canto. Now I wish to hear know about it elaborately. I also wish to know about the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by which he brought about the secondary creation." Sukadeva Goswami said, "O great sages assembled at Naimi Sharanya, after the great yogi Sukadeva Goswami heard King Parikshit's inquiry, he praised it and thus replied. Sukadeva Goswami said, when the 10 sons of Prachinabari emerged from the waters in which they were performing austerities, they saw that the entire surface of the world was covered by trees." We remember that King Prachinabari was performing Vedic rituals in which the killing of animals was recommended. Narada Muni, out of compassion, advised him to stop. Prachinabari understood Narada properly and then left the kingdom to perform austerities in the forest. His 10 sons, however, were performing austerities within the water, and therefore there was no king to manage to see the management of the world. When the 10 sons of Prachinabari came out of the water, they saw that the earth was overrun with trees. So Prabhupada particularly mentions here that especially when the government is negligent, less grains are produced. And describes that, quoting Bhagavad Gita 18:44, "The proper engagement for vaishyas according to their nature are to farm and protect cows. The duty of the chatras is to see that the members of the third class, the vaishyas, who are neither brahmins nor chatras, are thus properly engaged. Chatras are meant to protect human beings, whereas vaishyas are meant to protect useful animals, especially cows." Text number 5. "Because of having undergone long austerities in the water..." "Because of having undergone long austerities in the water, the chafers were very angry at the trees. Desiring to burn them to ashes, they generated wind and fire from their mouths." They had great mystic powers,
probably the same who made Lord Shiva, right?
Well, you know,
or was that anger justified?
Well, Srila Prabhupada goes to lengths in his purport to mention Vaishnavas, although they also have sufficient power and compassion, they do not become angry when put into difficulty. You know, they tend to be more tolerant and humble. So, you know, it's a reflection on the qualification in bhakti. The greater the qualification in bhakti, the...
They were not doing bhakti. They were meditating.
Yeah, they were meditating.
They were performing
austerities,
so they say that they're not. But they're also meditating on the Supreme Lord. So one day performing bhakti.
Yeah, Lord Shiva pointed them in that direction. Yeah.
Weren't they doing bhakti? Because they said that by bhakti you don't get that
result. Well, it depends on your qualification, your level of bhakti.
But they were doing bhakti.
Yeah, the Lord Shiva pointed them in the direction of bhakti. But, you know, there are different levels of bhakti. Greater the degree of bhakti, then the more exceptional are one's transcendental qualities. So that's you know, what will be brought out here in this section. Just like Indra, you know, Indra is also the body, and you become very angry. He was almost prepared to kill the Vrajavasis and the cows, and yet he was a devotee also. Indra was a devotee also. And he wanted to kill the cows and the Vrajavasis. He became angry.
So then you say a different class of devotees?
Yeah, you've got your Indra class of devotees and you've got
So how would you define Indra class of devotees? How would you define them?
They can become puffed up with their power and prestige.
Why would they get puffed up?
Because the degree of bhakti they have is beginning. It's not of the highest quality.
And they have powers.
They have powers from their previous or current austerity.
Mm-hmm. But probably
you can still use anger against an envious person, envious of the devotees is that also?
Yeah, it's one shouldn't tolerate. Offences against devotees of the Lord. So, you know, one can use anger in the service of the Lord, as Hanuman did. But, you know, generally in the scriptures, and especially Srimad Prabhupada, qualifies that with a warning that using anger in the service of the Lord is not to be imitated, because it's a very volatile, you know, just like in one purport Prabhupada says even nuclear weapons can be used in the service of the Lord. Right? So does that mean every devotee has, you know, carte blanche, go ahead to grab a nuclear weapon, and oh, Prabhupada says in Bhagavatam. So, you see what I mean? So Prabhupada says you can use nuclear weapons in the service of the Lord, that is it. But a as you can imagine, there'd probably be, you know, over hundreds of years where maybe the odds are open. So as you can see, generally, you know, if you go through Prabhupada's books where devotees have used anger, even properly, in the service of the Lord, there's usually a warning. This is not to be imitated. You know, using anger in the service of the Lord is not... something that someone who's, you know, very, very well trained and you know, shows that qualification. Generally, what happens in when there's anger is that you know, there's a loss of control. Mind and the senses. And we see also, you know, with the destruction of the Yadu dynasty, what began as an argument between a couple of Christian devotees got out of hand. So, you know, and therefore, you know, we don't try and practice using anger in the service of the Lord. We try to be very careful for anger to come at all. And therefore, you know, Lord Chaitanya used to be, it's better to be tolerant, humble, respectful like that. That we should practice. And anger, very rare that we will have to utilize that. And generally, you know, when anger should be used, you know, then like with anything that a devotee does, there should be proper training. You know, if a devotee is going to utilize anger in the service of the Lord, then you want to question them, what is their training? Saying, you know, devotees are going to preach Krishna consciousness from Srimad Bhagavatam, then we ask, what is your training in studying the Srimad Bhagavatam? If you're going to go into the kitchen and cook, then what is your training in cooking? If you're going to use anger, what is your training? So nothing is done without proper training like that. And some things are more difficult to utilize than others. So the general formula that we try is that sometimes when it comes up, and because we may not necessarily be properly trained, we just try to be tolerant and humble as that first option. I remember, you know, one time we were at a Rath Yatra in Auckland. And when, you know, the carts come back to the park and the city square, and we took the Jagannath off, and then we were going to have a little festival in the city square. And while one of the devotees was, you know, well, we did a little kirtan, and I think one of the devotees was speaking, I was in the temple president, and these Christians came and they started heckling. So there was a friend of mine who lived on the farm, who was a skinhead. You know, skinheads? You know, the skinhead. They had the very short hair, and some of them also had the Charles Manson cross to frost, you know, carved into their skin. They're usually particularly violent. No, Charles Manson. Charles Manson, very famous murders in the 60s. In the 60s and the 70s. Like a messiah, had a big hippie following. They lived on a ranch, and then they went and slaughtered all these innocent, famous movie star and people who were pushing and rape things and blood all over the walls. But, So, anyway, he was like that. Well, they like to wear the big boots with the metal heels, metal, you know, toes. And so when you kick or you stamp on someone, it really sort of crushes bones and stuff. So these Christians were standing there, you know, blaspheming, what have you. And he went around and stomped on their feet, you know, like he was breaking their toes and breaking their feet. Come back and you said, I'll fix them. That made me cry. And I said, thanks, but we generally, try to be humble and tolerant like that. But that's what happens when you get people who are, untrained, and they think, say he thought he was using anger, but, you don't want your movement to be done like that. You're breaking people's feet because they're sort of heckling the crowd. So I asked him not to do that for himself. My dear King Cricket, when Soma, the king of the trees, and the dominating deity of the moon, saw the fire and wind burning all of the trees to ashes, he felt great sympathy because he is the maintainer of all herbs and trees. To appease the anger of the Vichetas, Soma spoke as follows. Prabhupada puts here, he says, is due to the moonshine the trees and plants grow very luxuriantly. Therefore, how can we accept the so-called scientist whose moon expedition has informed us that there is no trees or vegetation on the moon? Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Soma, the predominating deity of the moon, is the king of all vegetation. How can we believe that the maintainer of vegetation has no vegetation on his own planet? So people like, for thousands of years, people from all different cultures in the world have planted their crops according to the moon. In general, when the moon is, waxing, you can plant seeds.
So some tribes that actually
know this? Many cultures. Practically all of them plant their crops according to the moon cycle. When the moon is growing and waxing, that's a good time, to begin the seeds and things like that.
Does that just mean how ignorant
and modern society? Yeah, yeah.
So they could say this to someone who's supposedly educated, they could say,
yeah, but, the moon also, has a big effect on the movement of liquids. So the oceans, of course, the tides, and it's actually recorded in medical journals that when you perform operations when the moon is full, people bleed more. Noted that. all the, yeah, it's a fact. Generally, you know, they understand there are some, you know, very significant scientific links between us and the moon. Presence in our bodies, you know, where they used to say 78% liquid water. Now they say it's more, much more than that. So you can imagine the effect that the moon has on us. You know, all the liquid within our brain cells. You know, it's so when the moon is strong or weak, it has a definite effect on the literal physical things that make up your body. So there's no way you can say it doesn't affect your mind. You know, if your brain, you got all the different brain cells, and you know, there's so much liquid, and you see what the moon does to the oceans, then how can it not affect your mind in some way or another? Physical.
It's contracting and then expanding.
What's that?
So the waxing and the waning of the moon.
Yes.
Is the moon basically, you know, becoming smaller and bigger, or
no?
Logical.
The moon is it's positioned between the sun, the earth, and the moon. Gravitational
pull. It's a
logical
one, it's not a physical.
Clearly,
it's not becoming thin.
No, the moon is not becoming thin,
okay.
It stays the same.
It's
yeah.
It's a logical phenomenon. Because of the shade and all that, you know, part is covered and all that.
That's right, but still, it's physical because its movement in relationship between the Earth and the Sun and the Moon creates different gravitational pulls in different directions on the liquids and the oceans and the waters in the world. There is a physical effect. What's that?
Is it related to the movement? Because I'm still like, I forgot what they've done before regarding the waning and the waxing.
Yeah, it's physical. I mean, the moon is it has you know, it has an orbit around the Earth. From a from the Earth's point of view, but you know, its movement around the Earth in relationship to the Earth creates different gravitational pulls and effects. But we won't get into that too much. But you know, physically, that's you know, that's going back to our fifth Kando studies. But that's a big discussion. We won't get that far. We understand, you know, the moon is one of the greatest factors affecting the tides. Yeah. So, you know, you can look it up in the encyclopedia. But you can actually look that up online if you like. And it'll show you, you know, how the moon affects the tides. It'll show you how it does its movement and why. So therefore, you know, it has an effect on our body, considering our body is mostly liquid. So it has an effect, and therefore, it would certainly also affect plants. And as we know, plants also are affected by light. You know, so you have the light, and sometimes there's more darkness at night, and sometimes there's greater light at night. And there is also a a much more subtle level. There are particular potency within the moon nodes. It's like there's a potency within the sun node. You know, they have all sorts of X-rays and gamma rays and this rays and that. And they all, you can do something with each of those rays, they'll affect you. Some of them give you cancer, some of them will cure you, you know, like that. So the moon also, you know, unknown to the scientists, but it has effect on the planet, especially. So, you know, those, they're very subtle signs. So we can't say, oh, the moon has, the sun has all these different effects with its rays has all sorts of different potencies, but the moon's just light, there's no nothing, no potency. You can't say that. We don't know what its potency is, but if the sun has all these potencies, why shouldn't the moon have all the potencies in its light? And for thousands of years, people have, you know, accepted that there is potency within the rays of the moon, especially towards planets and you know, and also the mind of that. So it's a very subtle science that needs further investigation scientifically. But the Bhagavatam is pointing the way. But you know, it's just illogical to say that you know, someone says, "Oh, the moon has no potency in its rays." That's illogical. Practically every light, every form of light, has a different potency, and you know, different forms of light, like sunshine, fire, they not only have one, but you know, you can separate a variety of different potencies and use them for different purposes. So the moon is the same. There's no reason why the moon should not have the same. That would be illogical.
Basically, in our extreme cases, what you explained now, in India, in both the cases, during the new moon day, some of the persons have got mental problems. The problem increases.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They, you know, they act on some
days. Yeah.
They put in separate rooms. No, this is in India, I've seen that every day.
Yeah, but
the full moon they're a little bit better.
That's right. There are, you know, records within psychology and the medical field of how people's minds and emotions and you know, say even operations are affected differently. The statistics stack up that there is something to it. But they don't know much more than that. Text number 7. Oh, greatly fortunate ones, you should not kill these poor trees by burning them to ashes. Your duty is to wish the citizens, prajas, all prosperity and to act as their protectors. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Hari, is the master of all living entities, including all the Prajapatis, such as Lord Brahma. Because he is the all-pervading and indestructible master, he has created all these trees and vegetables as eatables for other living entities. By nature's arrangement, fruits and flowers are considered the food of insects and birds, and other legless living entities are meant to be the food of four-legged animals like cows and buffalo. Animals that cannot use their front legs as hands are meant to be the food of animals like tigers, which have claws. And four-legged animals like deer and goats, as well as food grains, are meant to be the food of human beings. It says in the purport there that sometimes Kshatriyas Tertiary, generally the men of the higher class of society, the barons, chatrus and boshas, do not eat meat. Sometimes chatrus go to the forest to kill animals like deer because they have to learn the art of killing, and sometimes they eat the animals also. Sudras too eat animals such as goats. Cows, however, are never meant to be killed or eaten by human beings. In every shastra, cow killing is inherently condemned. Indeed, one who kills a cow must suffer for as many years as there are hairs on the body of a cow. Manushamhita says, we have many tendencies in this world, but in human life one is meant to learn how to curb those tendencies. Those who desire to eat meat may satisfy the demands of their tongues by eating lower animals, but they should never kill cows. They were actually accepted as the mothers of human society because they supply milk. The sastras especially recommend Krishi Guraksha. The Vaishya section of humanity should arrange for the food of the entire society through agricultural activities and should give full protection to the cows, which are the most useful animals because they supply milk to human society. So Krishi Guraksha, mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, means that the qualities of the vices is cow protection. So there in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna mentions quite strongly that cows should be given protection. And therefore, and as he says here in this purport, every scripture condemns the killing of cows. Every scripture. So, but lower animals may be eaten by those, so sutras. But, you know, Prabhupada would say, if you have to eat meat, just don't eat the cow. And he would say that you can eat a cow when it dies naturally. And he said that we will give you our cows when they die, you can eat them. You can have our cows. They die and you can eat them. But they should not be killed to be eaten. You know, generally from the higher classes, Brahmins, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas. So therefore, if someone says yes, meat is recommended, yes, for the lower classes. So, you know, if you have that desire, as we say, it is recommended for the lower classes. If you have that desire, you eat meat, as the other lower class people do, but not the cow. Just like in some cultures, you know, they eat their grandparents.
But don't they know that when they get old, then they will be eaten if they follow them?
Well, if they don't understand those things, and they want to eat meat, then if they're not able to understand those things, then just try and help them understand. Okay, so eat meat, but just don't eat the cow, because the cow is the mother. That's it. And you know, if they don't understand karma and you know the soul continues.
But even from a common sense point of view, you eat your grandparents in a society where you eat old people. Well, then one day you're going to become old, and you're going to eat.
That's right. So it's for lower class people of less intelligence, right? A lower class society of less intelligence would implement eating grandparents because they're so foolish to understand, well, you know, I'll eat them now, but, you know, I can't see far enough into the future to see that I will also end up in the cooking pot with an apple in my mouth. So, and similarly, Prabhupada's discussion, you know, generally we say to people that there is nowhere where it recommends you can do something, you can eat something without discrimination. That's not recommended anywhere. So it comes down to that. Now, if you have very little discrimination, you can eat nearly all sorts of rubbish and food, even if it's harmful to your health, even if it causes violence, even if it causes bad karma, so there's no sense of discrimination, then you eat all that. Those who have a very well-developed sense of discrimination are very careful what they eat. And generally, they, in the upper society of these ancient cultures, they did not eat meat at all. On the very rare occasion, for some particular circumstances, there was some meat eating. And on very rare occasions, by very rare few people in those upper classes, but generally they didn't. So therefore, it was a society with a well-developed sense of discrimination. But at the lower end, where that discrimination is less, there are different forms of media. But bottom line is, even those who have no discrimination are warned you cannot eat the cow. Text number 10. A pure-hearted one, your father, Tachinabhagi, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead have ordered you to generate population. Therefore, how can you burn to ashes these trees and herds which are needed for the maintenance of your subjects and descendants? The path of goodness traversed by your father, grandfather, and great-grandfathers is that of maintaining the subjects, judges, including the men, animals, and trees. That is the path you should follow. Unnecessary anger is contrary to your duty, therefore I request you to control your anger. As we learned in other sections of the Bhagavad Gita, the word praja refers to one who's taken birth within the jurisdiction of the government. So that's all living beings should be given protection. As the father and mother are the friends and maintainers of the children, as the eyelid is the protector of the eye, as the husband is the maintainer and protector of a woman, as the household is the maintainer and protector of beggars, and as the learned is the friend of the ignorant, so the king is the protector and giver of life to all his subjects. The trees are also subjects of the king, therefore they should be given protection. That's a nice verse, isn't it? A good one to quote.
Cutting of trees which are not useful in for giving grains, and that can be cut. Even if you want to create a field, have to take down all the
weeds and all that. Yeah, you do. So, just like sometimes, it's described that Yudhishthira Maharaj would root out rascals and thieves and etc. in his kingdom, like a farmer would remove weeds from the garden. So, what to speak of trees and weeds and what have you. Human beings become like weeds, they're also rooted out, killed. say, not able to, offer some practical contribution to society, and in fact they become a complete impediment. So sometimes there are some plants are like that. But auspicious trees, just like in the nectar devotion it describes, there's tulsi, the fig tree, the banyan tree. Different trees are considered auspicious. One must be very, very careful with, fruit trees. Fruit trees, we read in the Bhagavad Gita, are considered pious. So, just like with citizens, you have to be very careful with the pious citizens. You don't, it's the rascals that have to be punished or removed, but you have to be very careful. The pious people, it's like in China, in different places of the world, they want to build a dam, so they just remove, entire, hundreds of towns and cities along that route where the water is going to come. That have been there for thousands of years, they just don't care who's there, whether you're priests, the learned, they just remove them all and just, then they end up in some sort of a terrible situation because they've lost their home, they've lost their income, all the culture, everything's gone. And they put the dam in, it just comes down. But one has to be very, very careful. So in other words, you always have to consider that, plants that may be unwanted in a particular situation, if they're a pious or a very auspicious plant, then you may remove them and put them somewhere else, having consideration for the life of that plant. Sometimes it's easier just to, in Vrindavan, of course, there's that tree that grows right up in the courtyard. It's still there? The temple there? Who's been in Vrindavan? That tree still there?
There's one
tree
there.
Yeah. Was there one right in the
courtyard?
Yeah. So they just built the temple around it. So that's a big message in this film, isn't it? How careful you have to be. There's a tree that lives in Vrindavan. How careful you have to be. We want this temple here to get this tree right in the middle of it, put the building and get rid of it. And leave the tree there. Around. How careful. Pious trees. So sometimes, certain trees which are considered impious, they may actually be somewhat troublesome. They may have to be removed. Even then, you may use them for firewood or something like that. Be very careful with pious trees. But you can't treat each tree just that's a tree, that's a tree, that's a tree. Certain trees have that more significance.
So wouldn't they use it as a farm if they want to, they do a lot of chopping there, right? For fuel, or I don't know what they use, but do they discriminate there?
Well, quite often they tend to remove trees which either have fallen down in the wind. Quite often when we have those big storms, you get a lot of trees that fall down the forest, over the roads. Trees that may be about to fall on the property. There's that big sort of seat that's carved into the tree that's just near the temple corner. There's a big tree that used to be up in the at the farm. And it's carved into like a sheep, it's like a stone. Yeah? So I had that removed because I spoke to an arborist. I could see that it was dying, but I spoke to an arborist who said, yes, it's actually dying in the middle. And it was growing in such a way that two-thirds of its weight was towards the building. Now, when it would have come down, it would have crushed pretty much two-thirds of that big building there. It was a big one. So I got the people from next door to come and take that down for me, rather than wait till it fell on the building. And my understanding was, and the arborist's understanding was, that that would come down. And, you know, I've seen storms there where, you know, probably, you know, about 50 or 60 trees had come down within a couple of hours. Big trees. And so anyway, I got the people next door. They had, you know, they had big bulldozers and what have you. What they did was they tied it, you know, a metal wire, you know, that thick metal rope was made out. And they had it tied to like a huge, massive, big bulldozer, which was over near the other ashrams. And so it was, and they were going to put, so they cut the tree so that it would fall away from the temple, right? And then as a backup, they had the metal rope tied to the bulldozer. And even though they cut the tree to fall away, it still started to fall towards the temple as it came down, and it started dragging the bulldozer. And when I saw that, I thought, you know, at first I thought, we're going to crush the temple anyway. But then they had the bulldozer gun, and they managed to pull it back, and then it gradually came and went down. But, you know, if that rope had a break, it would have gone. But there's no doubt that no matter which way the wind was blowing, if that tree come down, and, you know, which it would, and it just got older because it was rotten, it just would have crushed that entire thing, because if there were people in it, they'd all be dead. So, you know, that was a big decision. But without doubt, I know that that tree, because of what I saw that day, there was only one way it was going to fall, and it would have taken out two-thirds of that whole thing. You know. So I wasn't going to risk it. So, you know, sometimes, you know, things have to be done, but, you know, there has to be, you know, some thought in it. You can't just take the tree out because it's in the way. You know, if it's some specific danger or what have you. You know. Yeah. But there has to be some thought in it. Prabhupada generally considered that Westerners, us, I don't know if they do that in India now, yeah, but you know, especially the Westerners, our tendency is if something is in the way, cut it down, remove it. Something's in the body that goes wrong, cut it out, get rid of it. Appendix, they don't do nothing, cut it out, chuck that in it. If medicine is like that, you know, something's wrong, cut it out, cut it off, you know, replace it with some robotic thing. So, you know, as Westerners, we have that tendency, Prabhupada knows that, you know, as slight as wind, trees in the way, that tree there, cut it down, you know, it just, you know, drop of a hat. That's our nature. So we have to be very careful of that. And this story here in Prabhupada's books. But that doesn't mean that every time someone cuts down a tree, they're doing the wrong thing. But certainly it's good when the discussions on that sort of thing are open and transparent so that the community can get involved. They wanted to cut this big palm tree down out here. And Gandharvika, who died of cancer, she mentioned to me, she was in tears. And, you know, they were saying, because at that stage the front fence was falling over. And they were saying that the roots were, had pushed the fence over, and the roots would destroy this temple here. And I spoke to Muni Chari, who was an arborist, and I said, because actually they dug up all the ground in front of the where the fence was, so you could actually see where the roots were. And I said, are those roots going to affect that fence? He said, no. And I said, is that tree dying? He said, no. And he said, why are they removing it? And I think they were going to sell it for some $1,000. And I said, if they take that tree out, what's its chances of living? About 50-50. So to take it out could make a lot of money, but its chances of dying were, you know, significant. Big tree like that. So my wife and I had a little protest, and we had a little kirtan around the tree, and then it advertised amongst the community. And strange enough, I gave a Bhagavatam at that time, a Bhagavatam class, at that time, and guess which verse I got? The one about the 10th canto, the one about the tree in Vrindavan. That was the verse I got in those days, the exact time that there was this big discussion about that tree. And that, after that class, I decided to leave it there.
That one,
that big palm tree. Yeah. All the ones around here got taken out. Yeah, the lemon tree, the fig tree. They did that like the politicians put through some unpopular bills in Parliament. They do it up the day before Christmas. You know that? And there's something, you know, if there's something that the politicians don't want, then when everyone's celebrating Christmas or something like that, push it through. No one's interested on those days. Yeah. And I think it was something like that, you know. All those trees come out much quicker than no one did. But it's better, you know, it's better when there's more transparency and discussion, you know, with significant members of the community. Well, that was obviously the opinion of the. There was certainly an imbalance that the Pachaitas considered. But Soma, the predominating deity, actually had a completely different opinion.
So the perception.
Yeah, and then, you know, also. Their anger, their, you know, was an overreaction to what needed to be done. As well.
Just on that one more though. Dhruva Maharaj was also such a great devotee.
Dhruva Maharaj.
He also becomes very angry when his brother is killed. But then that means even a great devotee, like we were talking about the difference in devotees, right? Guru Maharaj is only a top class devotee.
Yeah.
He also lost his anger.
Yeah.
He had to get angry at the Kshatriya to show them that what they had done was incorrect. And because he was a great devotee, the Lord sent Swayambhu Maharaj to check any excess anger.
Yeah, that's right. That's good. That's right. That's a good summary of what happened.
But my son, as a devotee, also, first of all, he virtually loses anger. Okay, it's been checked.
Yeah, it's kind of the same. There are different levels of devotees and. Above Dhruva Maharaj, you know, there are higher authorities. And, you know, therefore, what we see in the Bhagavatam is that it's not just because you're a devotee that, and a good one, with a good record of achievements, that that means that whatever you do is fine. That actually that's what happens. Sometimes what happens is that sometimes people think, this person's a good devotee, done some really significant things, therefore whatever that person does is acceptable. But we don't see that in the Bhagavatam. Dhruva Maharaj was a particularly, you know, we can't even, you know, estimate how high up he is, as you're saying. You know, we worship in personalities like Dhruva Maharaj. They're pure devotion, they're staunchness. But that doesn't mean, even on that platform, even Uddhava, who was one of the most confidential associates of Krishna, when Krishna wanted to send a message to the gopis, he chose Uddhava, but he also understood that Uddhava, as exalted as he was, unless he took lessons from the gopis in Vraja Prema Bhakti, he was like a child. And he had to learn. He couldn't just act in any way he wanted on the platform of Vrajabhati. He had no idea until he met the Vrajabhatis intimately. Then he could perform devotional service. So, above Dhruva Maharaj, way, way, way above, you had devotees like Uddhava. It doesn't mean that he can do whatever he likes either. He had to be trained. See? So, but that is one of the problems we have in ISKCON. And this is why, as I go back to this point, the disciples' course is meant to, the variety of authorities that we have in ISKCON is our protection. When we, when there is absolute authority placed in the hands of one person, that whatever this person does, that is correct. It always will be, always has been, and always is. That's a very dangerous position that we've been in ISKCON, and it has caused massive problems. So this is what we see in the Bhagavatam. And therefore, each temple, although they're independent and they run independently, within the temple there is supposed to be a variety of different authorities. It's not just goes on finances. You have a discussion with a couple of accountants and discussion's finished. There should be discussions with a variety of different authorities within a temple. And if there is something which is quite a considerable, which causes, some strong differing opinions, then, then help is sought from above. And when that's just, that makes it a healthy temple. Otherwise, we end up with problems. So, it's a good question. But this is what we see throughout the Bhagavatam. But it's a very interesting concept, that just because someone is a good quality devotee, that what they're doing is fine.
And that they can't make mistakes.
They can't make
mistakes. They can also make mistakes.
Oh, yes. Because it depends upon the quality of bhakti. And therefore, what actually, in a temple, or a zone, or a family, or a class group, where reciprocate according to the person's bhakti, then that is good. See? In other words, if the person who's put in a position of responsibility or leadership is not qualified, is not able to reciprocate the bhakti of the devotees under their care, then it impedes their decision-making process considerably. So, if the decisions are made upon other material considerations, there's a problem with that.
How do we learn from this?
Well, we're going to see what they do. We'll see the outcome. We'll see the outcome that's resolved. First of all, the first point that's being made is that Soma has very intelligently pointed out a contradiction in their mentality, that they're supposed to be prajapatis, or they're going to produce offspring, maintain and look after them, protect them, and to do that they're killing those who, in the long run, they're supposed to be protecting and maintaining. That's a very, their whole purpose in killing those trees is so they can maintain their citizens. And those trees are part of their citizens. So how can they maintain them by just killing them wholesale? So, in other words, their portfolio, their responsibility is to maintain each and every living entity. And that's how they should look at all the trees. Okay, some may have to go, some may have to be, cut back a little bit. But our first protection is which ones can we maintain, which can we protect? That's our responsibility. By all means, which ones do we not have to cause any harm to? That should be how they're looking at. It's like, but they're not doing that, are they? So that's the first thing that's been pointed out. And this is the danger of anger, isn't it? It usually leads to excesses.
Just one more point, just thinking. Because the trees have grown like a forest, there could also be a small animals in the forest.
Exactly.
Because trees basically in a shelter.
That's right, exactly. And what have they done? So that's right. So there's an indiscriminate action going on here. In the name of something, in the name of maintenance, actually the opposite is going on. So that doesn't make sense. And this is another, the Bhagavatam describes that in Kali Yuga, especially, but everything loses its essence, things have a name, but the very essence of that is gone. They're like, you call someone a mother, but they're not a mother, they kill their children. You call someone a friend, and if they're not a friend, they're obviously. You call someone a son, but they're not, or a daughter. They're not acting like children. They're acting like plunderers and enemies. You purchase food, but there's no, the fruit doesn't have a flavor anymore. It's like eating plastic. like it, and the essence of it, the flavour is gone, the goodness is gone. And sometimes you eat the food and it actually makes you unhealthy. So, you know, knowledge is no longer knowledge, it's actually ignorance. So, so here, what is the result of a nation? You see this in family life, that you know, families come together, you know, to you know, produce an environment where there's shelter and protection and nurturing and like that, and to find some peace and a little bit of shelter from the harshness of the world and the struggle in the world. But the home, you know, the actions that we produce create a different environment than, you know, that family situation is, you know, it's family and home, but the actions are producing a different environment. So this is what's happening here. And of course, here we're talking about a family on a great level. That everyone under the, everyone born, every living entity born under this government is part of his family. He should treat the rulers, the protectors should treat the trees, the plants, the children to be looked after like that, as one big family. That's not happening. Says text 13, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is situated as the super soul in the cause of the heart of all living entities, whether moving or non-moving, including men, birds, animals, trees, and indeed all living entities. Therefore, you should consider everybody a residence or temple of the Lord. By such vision, you will satisfy the Lord. You should not angrily kill these living entities in the forms of trees. Prabhupada says one should not destroy the body because of unnecessary envy. That would dissatisfy the super soul. Sangha told the potatoes that because they had tried to satisfy the super soul, now they should not displease him. So this is interesting, isn't it? Therefore, it's described that one of the principles of deity worship. You see, if you read the Panchapatika, the book that's put out by this on, you know, the manual for deity worship, you know, there's also other principles in deity worship, such as not disrespecting or not causing harm to any living entity. So in other words, it's mentioned in the 11th canto also that if one worships the deities in the temple, as a pujari, and goes in there and dresses the Lord and puts on the beautiful crown and, you know, everything like that, and then comes out of the deity room and causes harm and violence to any living entity, it displeases the deity. And that's what they've done. What did they spend? How many thousand years? He spent so many thousands of years meditating like yogis, so seeing something wonderful, and then they come straight out, and therefore you see that you know, we talk about levels of bhakti. You know, a neophyte of God will worship the deity in the temple, cannot deal properly with other living entities or other devotees, and they may cause be disrespectful or envious and act in that way to devotees or living entities in general. And so, for instance, you know, we had big festivals. It's like we're having Sringa Chaturdasi coming up. So one may come to Sringa Chaturdasi and, you know, spend a lot of time, you know, worshipping the deity. But then if the person then comes out and causes some trouble to other living entities, or especially to Vaishnavas, they've actually done all of that trouble to please the Lord, which looks like a wonderful show, but actually the Lord understands that that envy is in the heart, and at the first opportunity, one does something to displease the Lord. So it's a very, what you say, neophyte or immature stage of bhakti, isn't it? I can see the Lord in the temple, but I can't see the Lord in the hearts of other living entities. The Majjhimadhikari, they can. The Majjhimadhikari, they see the Lord there in the temple, but they see the Lord in every living entity, therefore they can preach. You know, and that's why Prabhupada says, not everyone can preach. Because if they can stand before the deity and see the Lord, and when as soon as they're with other people and they can't perceive the Lord in the heart, how can you preach? Especially if there's some, you know, envy, which there will be. So,
there is one point that sometimes you need to kill all these cockroaches must be gone, the mouse.
Mm-hmm. Say that again?
The cockroaches,
yeah.
And mouse, and then this kind of people, so they're disturbing us, and then angry will kill it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Must be biting you with his blessing, just kind of angry. So,
yeah.
Especially in cockroaches, it creates, you know, a lot of trouble. The guy that changing my view,
you know, sometimes some things are unavoidable. Just like immunization, you know, when you get immunization, you have to kill so many living entities within your body in order to make the body healthy. I mean, but there's a lot of disagreement against immunization, because sometimes, you know, there's all sorts of things wrong with it. But antibiotics or something, you put that in your body and you kill so many bugs to keep the body and all the other living entities within you that are healthy within the body alive. So we do that on a regular basis. You know, a lot of medicines. If you get sick, what do? You go to the doctor. The doctor says, you got some virus, you have to kill it. Kill all those little bugs going around in the system. You do that, but if you don't, you're going to die along with all the other living entities. So, you know, some things are unavoidable, and therefore, for instance, you know, if you run a kitchen, you know, in some parts of the world, you know, you can have the odd, you know, bug running around, but in the West, it's got to be completely sterile, and if it's not, they'll close your kitchen down.
In Bhopal, there is a sewage flow and there are rats and
they
have been killed.
Yeah.
Regularly
they do it. That's right.
In the city.
Yeah.
Is there any pastor? I think I heard, but I don't remember. Prabhupada used to say that it's something that just happened
in the city. Well, Prabhupada mentions how his father used to put a little bowl of rice out in his shop so that, you know, the mice used to come in instead of eating the cloth, they would eat the bowl of rice and they'd be satisfied with
that. Last year, I think it was in October, it said it was so many mouses coming every day.
Where that? Back
to
October.
Then zero mouse. But it was so irritating. Night time, we couldn't sleep sometimes. They are biting our fingers.
But they make the problems.
Trying to get a bit of dust.
But I know one day we have one devotee for Kedar Mandal.
So
we tried so many ways, didn't work properly, and then some glue, that is also painful actually. start and keep it any other way to die. Anyway, so finally got rid of that.
So it's a big discussion, but so certainly sometimes these things, we read in the previous verse that the Chattris had to go into practice the art of killing. They had to kill something. They went in the forest, they killed deer, sometimes a tiger, sometimes a rhinoceros, and that. In order, to practice, you've got to, you get a young boy who's never killed anything, and all of a sudden that they're, standing there face to face with a human being that they have to kill to punish, they're not going to be able to do it. They have to toughen up a bit. Kill a deer, and they'll probably cry their heart out when they kill the first deer. They'll probably, get on their knees and cry. I killed that deer. And gradually, it becomes, a commonplace thing where they can just go into battlefields and kill thousands of men and not hesitate for a split second. So, it has to, so as you can see, there is facility for killing, but not that the Chattris go in and just, like duck hunting, kill as many as you can, put a trophy up. How many do you kill? I kill 1,000, look at my trophy, I'm the winner. So it's not trophy hunting, but, for a very specific, limited application. So killing is there, and also, cleanliness is there, and sometimes hygiene and the danger of, you go to Rio de Janeiro, you get bitten by a mosquito, and you could have children born with Zika virus, and they have the little heads. You seen that? The Zika virus? Yeah. Well, they haven't. Thousands of children have been born in that part of the world with little heads because of the Zika virus, which is transmitted by the mosquito. So now they have to kill the mosquitoes. So, so it's a big discussion, but it's not indiscriminate. Yeah.
What is the chemical? The rats.
I've seen that. I've seen it on TV.
Rats, they feed the rats.
Yeah, and another one with snakes. Another village with snakes.
And the rat is supposed to be the vehicle of damage.
Yeah. The vehicle.
The Maharashtra village is with the rats. Most of the Maharashtra people live in the bathroom.
And they say that elephants are scared of mice, so that just proves that theory, doesn't it? Alright. One who inquires into self-realization and thus subdues his powerful anger, which awakens suddenly in the body as if falling from the sky, transcends the influence of the modes of material nature. So now he comes to it. So he's pointed out, first of all, there's an anomaly. You're saying you're going to maintain and protect the citizens, so why are you killing them all? That's not maintaining and protecting them. It's obvious that the anger is causing you to do something else, and now he says, so now you have to control that anger. So he's proved it. There's a problem with the anger, and you have to control it. And nice verse in Bhagavad Gita about that. So now, one who obtains such control over all these things, love, greed, anger, etc., will always be transcendently situated, untouched by the mode of material nature. This is only possible when one fully engages in the service of the Lord. As the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 14:26, Mancha Yoga, Vicharina, Bhakti Yoga, Nisavati Sagana, Santita, Chandra, Mabuya, Kapate. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down in any circumstances, at once transcends the most mature nature and thus comes to the spiritual platform. So the Prabhupada says, by engaging one in devotional service, the Krishna consciousness movement keeps one always transcendental to anger, greed, lust, envy, and so forth. One must perform devotional service because otherwise one will become victimized of the modes of mature nature. So mark that verse, because that's the mood and mission statement, which you know will go in one of your essays. That's text number 14. Anyone who's not fully engaged in devotional service will become the victim of anger, greed, lust, envy, and so forth. Therefore, he says, there is no need to burn those poor trees any longer. Let whatever trees still remain be happy. Indeed, you should also be happy. Now, here is a beautiful, well-qualified girl named Alicia, who was raised by the trees as their daughter. You may accept this beautiful girl as your wife. We see, and going back to text number 8, another important point is that Soma, you know, as he said, that this vegetation was created by the Lord of Lords to provide food for everyone. If the Crusaders tried to kill them off, their own subjects would also suffer. The trees are required for food. Part of the environment. Kill off the forest, you kill off the animals that live in it. Sukadeva Goswami continued, my dear king, after that, that is there, and then in text 13 we get the spiritual argument, and that is that you have to consider everybody a residence or temple of the Lord. So there's an ecological argument he gave. He also pointed out the hypocrisy of what they were doing, and also, you know, that in text 13 that everybody is a residence or the temple of the Lord. Sukadeva Goswami continued, my dear king, after that pacifying the potatoes, Soma, the king of the moon, gave them the beautiful girl born of Kamlocha Apsara. The potatoes all received Kamlocha's daughter, who had high, very beautiful hips, and married her according to religious systems. So she was the daughter of Kamlocha Apsara, but she was raised by the trees as her daughter.
It's really difficult to understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like Jungle Book.
No, but that's an
accident. You know, Mowgli, he was raised by the wolves. She was raised by the trees and the animals within the trees, I guess, by the forest. She was raised by the forest. It was the same as Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book. Yeah, that verse 17. In the womb of that girl of the Chafis, all begot a son named Daksha. killed the three worlds with living injury. So, it would appear that the yogis' sperm is considered very potent, and it appears that the combination of the tender yogis' sperm is exceptionally potent. Daksha was first born during the reign of Svayambhuva Manu, but because of offending Lord Shiva, he was punished by having the head of a goat substituted for his own head. Thus insulted, he had to give up that body. And in the sixth Manvantara, called the Chakshusha Manvantara, he was born of the womb of Marisha as Daksha. In this connection, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes this verse. His previous body had been destroyed, but he, the same Daksha, inspired by the Supreme Will, created all the desired living entities in the Chakshusha Manvantara. Thus, Daksha regained his previous opulence and again begot thousands and millions of children to fill the three worlds. So, we had heard so it says here, in the womb of the Vichaitas, all begot a son named Daksha, who filled the three worlds with living entities. So this episode is taking place in the Svayambhuva Manu.
The previous Daksha was the same, the previous one was
So there was the creation of living entities in the Svayambhuva Manu, Manvantara. And there's a further creation of Marisha, raised by the trees. Marisha was married to the Pachetas, and they're from the Svayambhuva Manu, Manvantara. They begot a son named Daksha. Daksha was first born during the reign of Svayambhuva Manu. No, Dakshin was originally one of the sons of Brahma, wasn't he? He was one of the sons of Brahma. He was one of the ten sons of Brahma, Dakshin, right? But then, because of offending Lord Shiva, he was punished by having the head of a goat. That's in solid. He had to give up that body, and in the sixth Manvantara, called the Chakshu Manvantara, he was born in the womb of Rishi as Daksha. His previous body had been destroyed, but he, the same Daksha, inspired by the Supreme Will, created all the desired living entities in the Chakshu Manvantara. So in the Svayam Bhuva Manvantara, we have the creation of some of the living entities. And although Daksha was born in the Svayam Bhuva Manvantara as one of the sons of Brahma, he was later reborn again from Marisha and also created many millions of children, variety of different children. Daksha has an appearance twice, one of the son of Brahma, one of the son of Marisha and the Pratatis.
Yes, that's right now.
And it appears that we know that Daksha does create children in the Chakshusha Manvantara as the son of Marisha. Whether he also did a similar thing says here, because of offending Lord Shiva, he was punished by having the head of a goat substituted for his own head. That insulted, he had to give up that body. And in the sixth Manvantara, called the Chakshusha month, he was born in the womb of Marisha as Daksha. So, it appears that after the insults, he gave up his body, as the Sahasrara sort of mentioned. So,
isn't
that suicide though? We are then a people that become a ghost. For them, there's a different view. They take their body. Well, in this sense, it appears that, possibly, but, in this sense, he wanted to, he was not giving up his body to avoid his duty, but in order to fulfill it. So he's taken birth again to fulfill his duty of being a Prajapati. But it appears that, he may have trouble.
Do we have a choice where we are going to be born?
Whether it's suicide, to fulfill a higher duty, or whether it's suicide.
The sentence is that because he had a ghost body,
yeah,
he felt insulted and so he was giving up his
Yeah.
He didn't do it to do a higher job. He did it because he couldn't tolerate the insult.
Yeah, it's probably a combination of both of them. Yeah.
And it so happened, despite that, my question, despite doing that,
mm.
he had been given a chance to propagate human mankind. That is the mercy of the Lord. But normally, when you come to such a suicide like this, you are born as a ghost and you have to suffer.
Mm. Well, it'd be something like me coming to give Srimad Bhagavatam class wearing a big bunny suit. You know? They'll sit there and laugh at me. It'd be very hard. It'd be very, very difficult. You know? It'd be very difficult for him to. His position was ludicrous, you know. Trying to. You know, daksha means one who's very expert at sex for, you know, producing children. But it's very hard to have sex life when you've got the head of a goat. You know, you can say that's insulted, or as a result of the insult, he had to give up his body. I mean, the insult basically made his position ludicrous. Here's someone who's... So, you know, it'd be a combination of both feeling insulted, definitely, and also his position becoming ludicrous. So, yes, he has, you know... when it says he had to give up that body, I'm not sure how he did give up that body. And
well, is it at that level? Because Brahma also felt ashamed when he ran up to the top, and so he gave up that body. So
he had to give up that body.
So there, if it's giving up the body, is it at a different level that we it's not similar to us?
Yeah, it's not exactly the same as suicide. You know, Brahma also literally had to relinquish that body in order to perform his role as
Brahma. But then Brahma
didn't
have to be born. He just had it on his body. Like Daksha, he had to be born.
Yeah.
For Brahma, he just...
But Brahma is self-born.
He just took another body.
Yeah, but Brahma is self-born. He's the only living entity in the universe who's self-born. Brahma always remained self-born. But he did take another body. But he took his birth as Haridasa Kaur, but he didn't give up his body as Brahma, necessarily. But, it's a form of suicide, but it is on a different level. These are very, very great exalted personalities, and we're reading about, you know, periods in their life where they've made some major boo-boo. It doesn't mean, you know, everything that they, just like Indra, you know, when he offended Krishna. It was a major mistake. We're going to hear more about Indra, you know, after this section. It doesn't mean that everything he does is foolish. You know, these are big instances that in their lifespan only took up, you know, a short span. They're great personalities, and they're to some degree above the same standards that the rest of the universe is in. So, yes, it's suicide, but when you're such a great personality, and you know, they're replacing one body with another body to continue basically in the same position, and they've been purified by the saints and the sages and what have you. It's a, so in other words, Lord Shiva, the punishment was given. This is like someone goes to prison or get a fine, and they get a fine for speeding. You pay the fine, purification, okay, won't speed again. And that, the person is not looked at always for the rest of their life as a speeder, unless they're a repeat offender. But, you know, these are great personalities. We're talking about a period in the life where they slip up, they get purified, they get punished, and they just move on to do what they, you know, usually do. And on that level, and especially when they are dealing with great saints and saviors such as Narada Muni and Lord Brahma and Krishna himself, and, you know, their purification is there. So it's not quite exactly the same. There's a lot of other variables there. You know, that's an interesting concept, because you've got two things. We were talking before about when you have devotees who have a very good standing as a devotee, and sometimes they do, we understand that not everything they do is correct. Not everything they do is correct. Just because they're a good devotee. Even very elevated. Here we have demigods, a daksha, and etc. They're also devotees, not everything they do is correct. At the same time, when a devotee or a demigod does make some mistake, because they are great personalities, they're not exactly dealt with in the same way as others. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, that even if they commit the most abominable activities, because they're properly situated in devotional service, they're considered saintly. See? So, you know, therefore, okay, he's committed suicide, what have you. So there's two things to consider, you know. One, we have to deal with devotees in all respects. Anyone who's a devotee is someone like, you know, top, they've reached the top perfectional stage of, advancement of consciousness. So Krishna treats them in a different category to all other varieties of human beings. So they're great personality. And at the same time, just because they're on that platform doesn't mean that they're not capable of committing some other further mistakes. But when they commit those mistakes, the purification is through Krishna and other great personalities. It's not on the same level as others. You see, so Krishna is saying, you know, devotee commits some abominable activity. Okay, it's abominable. He's not saying, they can do it, and when they do it, it's good. He's saying it's abominable. They've done something which is not correct. It's not correct. It's abominable. But, you know, because they're under Krishna's protection, their actions are considered differently. And generally what they do is they just go on with their devotional service. So, you know, it's a similar thing with these. Here, Daksha is, whether he's committed suicide or what have you, but we have to consider the position of these demigods, and at the same time understand that they, because they're great personalities, not everything they do is necessarily correct. They appear to be two opposing factors, don't they? And this is why it's hard to deal, you know, it's sometimes hard to, for people outside of ISKCON to deal with some of the internal difficulties that go on within ISKCON. You know, to some degree. Yeah.
I think it's these, such kind of people, they start judging ISKCON completely.
They can't, they have no access. They have no access, they have, you know, there are certain understandings that are there within ISKCON. People at least have the understanding this person is a devotee. They've done something wrong, but they're a devotee. So it is treated in a different category than just an ordinary person who's not a category. It's not as if they're going to get away with murder. It's not as if they haven't done something wrong. But it's still treated differently.
The outside world will not only judge you, but they will judge the whole process.
Exactly. They're not able to do it. They're not able to understand the categories that the body is in. But it should. So, in saying that, ISKCON therefore has to step up and actually have a process by where they rectify devotees who are doing something wrong. And if they don't do that, then they have no other recourse but allow the external legal and moral standards, to come in and exact some punishment, which may be, not properly considering a devotee situation. So, for instance, just like this happens. Say, in Maori people come from the islands, the Maoris, and or some of the Aborigine communities. Now, when they break the law, they're also not treated by the law exactly the same. Sometimes they're actually allowed to go back within their community, and the elders who understand the Aboriginal culture or the Maori culture deal with them, supporting them in a way that our society and our laws cannot do. So even that's understood within Maori, Aborigines, there are special exceptions, and the law recognises that. You know, we actually have to consider them. They've done something that in our Western culture, our white culture, what have you, this is the law. But because they're from a different category, they're actually from an Aboriginal community, we actually have to take that into consideration. And the same happens within, Krishna says, within ISKCON, or, you know, for devotees in general, and the same also for demigods. They're a different category. Okay? So,
then, because in criminal law, they take mental illness actually considered to be a defense to some of the worst, even the worst crimes, like murder or manslaughter.
Yes.
Is that basically supported?
Well, Prabhupada used to give the example that he cited one case of a lawyer he knew. Someone had killed someone and they pleaded insanity, and their lawyer presented that to the judge, and then they asked for the other lawyer's reply. The other lawyer's reply was it to the judge that in this world everyone has some degree of craziness, and therefore if you forgive this person you have to forgive everyone like that. And the judge agreed. Okay, so Prabhupada cites that example that, you know, everyone to some degree in this world is, you know, crazy. And the scriptures, basically, if you come to this world, you're born into this world by lust and envy. And that envy and anger and that strong desire is a form of where you have no control of your mind, but the lust has control of your mind. You have no control of your mind and senses. The anger has control of it. And that loss of control of your mind and senses is a form of madness. When you have no control of your mind and senses, that is a different form of madness, and therefore everyone in this world has some different form of madness to the degree that they can't control their mind and senses. And therefore, Prabhupada gives that example. So, it has to come into it to some degree, but not completely. You know, you can't plea everything insane, because actually everyone is insane, and therefore the law would become useless. All right, so So I'll just read on. Does that answer that question? Yeah.
I was just thinking of another purport where Srila Prabhupada says that just as an insane man is not liable for murder, a devotee does not hold a non-devotee liable for the offenses he commits against him, understanding that he is, in a literal sense, mad, being completely under control of the three modes of material
nature. Yeah, so there's some consideration. It's not a blanket, you know, you're off the hook. The devotee is considering that, but those people are still subject to karma, aren't they? So, we know, they killed a cow, and we're thinking, shit, no control, my own senses, but he's going to get the karma. So, and Krishna's also thinking, they've lost control of the mind and senses, they're doing so many horrible things in the material world, they've gone crazy. But he's still giving the karma. So let's just read a couple of verses until we get up to Daksha's prayers. Alright, so there's only a couple of here, just to finish the class. Sukadeva Goswami continued, please hear from me with great attention how Prajapati Daksha, who is very affectionate to his daughters, created different types of living entities through his semen and through his mind. So, as it describes here, apparently Daksha had no son, he had daughters, and that the living entity were born through his daughters. With his mind, Prajapati Daksha first created all kinds of demigods, demons, human beings, birds, beasts, aquatics, and so on. There you go. But when Prajapati saw that he was not properly generating all kinds of living entities, he approached a mountain near the Vindhya mountain range, and there he executed very difficult austerities. Near that mountain was a very holy place named Agarmashan. There Prajapati Daksha executed ritualistic ceremonies and satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, by engaging in great austerities to please him. My dear king, I shall fully explain to you the Hamsaguru prayers which were offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead by Daksha, and I shall explain how the Lord was pleased with him for those prayers. So these prayers, as described, were not composed by Daksha, but were existing in Vedic literature. When we meet next week, we will hear those Hamsaguru prayers and the results that he got from chanting those. So if you read those, nice and philosophical, a bit of philosophical homework, exercise your so they go up to, those prayers go up to verse 34, and then there's a few chapters. It goes up to, we'll finish this chapter, it goes up to verse number 54. So there's about 20 texts of prayers. Thank you very much. Sri Prabhupada, Ki Jai, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki Jai.